Hello, and welcome to Into the Night, a Five Nights at Freddy's podcast. I am your host, Nick, and thank you for listening. It has been about a month now since the release of what might be the most for-the-fans film ever produced, and to say the response hasn't been polarizing would be an understatement. Five Nights at Freddy's 2 has received a decidedly mixed reception. Most critics have dismissed it outright as poor filmmaking, while a significant portion of the fandom has praised it as excellent. At least excellent for what it set out to be. Yet when shifting through the broader online discourse throughout the month, the prevailing sentiment seems to land somewhere in the middle. Frankly, after now watching it a third time, I think I can officially label the film as average to mediocre. Personally, I think it's difficult to ignore how much the film's more charitable reception may stem from the broader state of modern Hollywood. When so much contemporary output feels creatively bankrupt, a movie that would have been considered merely above average in the mid-2000s or early 2010s can appear, by comparison, like a diamond in the rough in the 2020s. I mean, clearly even I found myself shifting opinions over time with this film, initially rating the film a 4 out of 10, then a 6 out of 10 on a second viewing, and ultimately I've settled somewhere in the middle, acknowledging both the film's deeply flawed creative decisions and my own unavoidable bias as a longtime FNAF fan. And that bias, the instinctive dismissal of criticism towards something you've come to identify as part of yourself, has become an increasingly prominent issue with the FNAF community with this film. After more than a decade, fans have entered a familiar dynamic reminiscent of the Nintendo or Valve relationship, a love-hate bond defined by frustration with baffling decisions that often feel tailor-made to irritate the audience, tempered by the knowledge that the core product remains compelling enough to keep us invested. You accept that you can't have everything, and in doing so, develop a peculiar sense of ownership with it. One where you reserve the right to criticize the series, while simultaneously defending it against outside detractors and so-called tourists. After all, only we are allowed to say when this franchise is being mismanaged. And look, despite the heartwarming notion that art should be made for the fans, the reality is that art and commerce have never existed independently of one another, no matter how much you may wish to separate them. Michelangelo's ceiling of the Sistine Chapel would not exist without the chapel itself, certainly. But it also would not exist without Pope Julius II, who made a payment of 3,000 ducats for the commission. The same principle applies to modern media. Video games, books, and films, even those created by independent artists, are ultimately subject to the expectations of producers, if involved, and to the desires and standards of an audience. Even works we now regard as timeless art were born from commercial motivations. Road Dolls, Willy Wonka, and the Chocolate Factory's theatrical release in 1971, for instance, only came into fruition because Quaker Oats funded the project under the belief that it could turn a profit, not only from the film, but from the production and sale of newly branded Wonka bars that would line the store shelves alongside the film's release. The Wonka bars turned out to be flawed in that they melted in the aisles, but the point still stands. Art can transcend its origins, but it is almost always enabled by consequence, by material or commercial incentive. For this reason, the defense of "it's made for the fans" has always just rung hollow to me. I mean, from a purely pragmatic standpoint, refusing to appease an already established audience one we might call the existing customer base in business terms, is little short of project suicide. One need only look at the recent trend of Hollywood creatives attempting to court the now infamous and frequently mocked concept of the modern audience. This idea operating on the insulting presumption that the public has become too fragile or intellectually incurious to engage with challenging material, and that art must therefore be flattened into didactic propaganda, less concerned with internal exploration and promotion of thought than with just simply instruction and repeating what you already agree with. The result of this mindset speaks for themselves. Numerous long-standing franchises have been left creatively destitute and culturally degraded after being handed over to successors more interested in reshaping the work than understanding it. Individuals who inherited the legacy without appreciating the artist and the foundations upon which it was built on. These properties were then further rejected by audiences, most notably, first, by their own fandoms, who felt betrayed, condescended to, or simply forced to witness something that stood in direct opposition to what many Gen Zers would call absolute cinema. It being made for the fans is not a radical or controversial claim. It is a basic, rudimentary understanding of the relationship between artist, benefactor, and audience, one that has existed for as long as art itself. So why, on God's green earth, would a high-budget film funded by multiple benefactors and sustained by an ecosystem of careers reliant on theatrical continued profitability be made with the explicit intention of segmenting its audience so severely?
Think, Mark, think!
To suggest that only those who have fully absorbed this world to the point where it constitutes a portion of their identity are permitted to meaningfully engage with it is either an act of stubborn hubris on the creator or a weak, reflective response to criticism the film has been met with. Likely it is some combination of both. That is to say, if I'm going to be speaking, ranting, at length about this film as a fan of Five Nights at Freddy's and the work of Scott Cawthon, but also as a thinking human being who values artistic growth and cultural improvement, I must necessarily dwell on its shortcomings first. Not to tear it down, but so those shortcomings can be examined, addressed, and improved upon, rather than ignored or papered over. And if you are a content creator shrouding any form of continued long-form franchise storytelling, your Warhammer 40Ks, your Star Wars, your FNAF, or, you know, more niche subjects, you want things to improve if there are faults. You either want things to be met at a standard, or if they are falling short of that standard, be fixed so that it can exceed expectations.
Don't ask questions. Just consume product and then get excited for next product.
Because the nature of art and storytelling is not akin to baking a cake, to use the allegory Scott himself used when it came to Security Breach all those years back. I know, Security Breach, but hear me out. Where an undercooked or crumbling side of a cake can be hidden beneath frosting, sprinkles, or decorative excess, sweet sugar adds nothing of substance on top of an already sugary cake. And visual dazzle is more so to elevate an already existing good product. But yes, it can also be used to distract the senses from a structural failing. The art of storytelling is closer to architecture. It requires a foundation, deliberate layering, internal logic, and an intent behind every element of its construction. Now, not every micro decision needs to have 5 pages of backstory, but Chekhov's gun exists for a reason. You don't add details randomly if they don't come into play later on. And when part of the infrastructure, the plot in this case, is missing essential components, no amount of surface-level embellishment can compensate for that absence. Ignore faulty construction long enough, and the integrity of the entire structure is compromised. Allow such failures to compound, and eventually, the house collapses. For this reason, it is vital that we remain honest with ourselves, even when that honesty is uncomfortable, especially when the art or the artist behind it has helped shape who we are. Whether that identity is rooted in fandom, Finance at Freddy's, Harry Potter, Warhammer, Star Wars, Tolkien, Downton Abbey, Stranger Things, The Witcher, or in the broader labels we could adopt as book readers, movie buffs, gamers, and the countless subcultures that branch from those. Or whether the influence runs deeper still, shaping our moral framework, the heroism of warriors wielding sword or pen, the wisdom of maternal figures, or the quiet strength and protectiveness of paternal ones. Everything in the natural world must grow, and art, as an imitation of nature, follows the same rule in all but one crucial way. Art does not decay in the natural sense. Art only decays when its stewards, the inheritors of an artist's legacy, fail to uphold the standards, values, and intents upon which that work was founded. In this way, art resembles more the human soul, enduring, persistent, and resistant to time itself. It is only when that soul is deliberately neglected or actively corrupted, whether through malice or carelessness, that it can be truly destroyed. So, with all that philosophical rigmarole out of the way, let's begin. Here is the unbridled rage over why this film was ultimately a disappointment, not just to the fans, but to everyone involved. Into the Night will be right back after these messages.
If you're an HVAC technician and a call comes in, Grainger knows that you need a partner that helps you find the right product, fast and hassle-free. And you know that when the first problem of the day is a clanking blower motor, there's no need to break a sweat. With Grainger's easy-to-use website and product details, you're confident you'll soon have everything humming right along. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
First, let's be modern game theory for a moment and commit to being an absolute contrarian. Let's start at the very beginning of the film, Charlotte's death. I've seen this scene widely praised online as probably the strongest moment in the movie. And on some level, I agree. On some level. But even at its best, the scene is weighed down by something so absurd it becomes impossible to ignore. Just the parents, or rather the complete emotional vacuum they seem to exist in. I said this in my original review, this is one of those moments where Scott Cawthon's writing works far better in the theater of the mind than it ever could on the big screen. Because now we have a budget, and with that budget comes limitations. I can already picture how Scott imagined this moment, Freddy Fazbear in his heyday, wall to wall with kids and families, sensory overload everywhere. Obviously, parents will be distracted by their own children. Staff stretched thin, noise drowning out everything. Charlotte runs from table to table, unseen, unheard. Conceptually, it works. But I'm sorry, no. You're not going to convince me that a child screaming and crying the way Charlotte is wouldn't draw at least one adult's attention. Not one parent pausing mid-conversation in this mildly busy day at Freddy Fazbear's. Not one uneasy glance. Not one, hey, is that kid okay? That scene demands a level of communal apathy that borders on parody, and it set the tone straight from there throughout the rest of the film that we're gonna be doing some really, really dumb things here. And honestly, as a Five Nights at Freddy's fan, this scene hurts way more when you have more knowledge on the series. Because the reason Charlotte's death was altered is obvious. This film was written with her being positioned as the central antagonist, her spirit acting with intent, agency, and control, rather than being one more victim lost in the machinery and the effects of the preternatural like the MCI children. The idea of Charlie directly influencing the toys through her own will, instead of introducing yet another batch of dead kids, is, on paper, a cleaner narrative choice. I mean, even in FNAF lore, the second missing children incident, or as some prefer to call it, the dead children incident, it has always been one of the more undeveloped, and not uncompelling, but disappointingly bare threads in the franchise. Contrast that with The Bite of 87, a mystery that works precisely because it remains a mystery. We don't need confirmation of who did it. The implication that Jeremy Fitzgerald, the Night Guard in FNAF 2, may have been the victim is enough information to theorize without suffocating the event under exposition or having the mystery linger far longer than it's good for, building up the expectation for a reveal that would disappoint a far more people because of the contradictory information, such as Golden Freddy. The Bite of 87 is just good storytelling, but the second set of murdered children, they're just kind of there in the FNAF world. Five kids, dead, largely forgotten. And even now, with the film giving the toy animatronics a bit of a long overdue attention, it still feels strange, almost wrong. These victims don't receive the same care, reverence, or narrative weight as the original missing children's incident victims. And look, I want the toys to come back. I really do. There's something unsettling and unfinished about them this series has never fully resolved. But as it stands, this scene doesn't clarify the lore so much as it reopened an old wound and reminded us of how unevenly the franchise has always treated its own history. However, back to the film proper, the choice of having Charlotte's death portrayed this way also does not come without consequence. The original death of Charlotte, long before we even knew her name, was shrouded in mystery. And you can argue that since the movies seem to be tailoring themselves to the chronological order of when the games release, FNAF 1, FNAF 2, FNAF 3, that would be an appropriate way to handle her story, leave some details out. But as her character was further defined as the franchise continued, particularly in Freddy Fazbear's Pizzeria Simulator, FNAF 6, an essential, irrevocable element of Charlotte's death emerged, that being betrayal. William Afton's murder of Charlotte was not an act of concealment as the film portrays it. It was an act of pure malice. He did not kill her to hide a crime. He committed the crime because he could. He exploited Charlotte's innocence and the trust placed in the Emily family, luring her into the alley under false pretenses before murdering the daughter of his best friend. That betrayal is the point. It is the moral event horizon that defines William Afton not merely as a criminal, but as a monster. And yes, the film's version of events arguably aligns more closely with the tone of the original three games. But if you are going to employ characters that were later refined and recontextualized during what many would consider the second half of Scott Cawthon's creative golden age, then you cannot ignore why those characters were expanded in the first place. They were no longer meant to be set dressing, vague figures orbiting a spooky location, but agents of narrative consequence, Their actions mattered. Their choices had weight. In portraying William's murder of Charlotte as a pragmatic attempt to cover his tracks adds nothing to his character that we didn't already know. We already understand that he kills children. What did add something vital in FFPS, was the revelation that he kills through manipulation, that he weaponizes trust to a degree of knowing a lot more about his victims than just simply picking and choosing from the lot, that the abyss where his heart should be is not really empty, but actively hostile to human connection, that is far more damning than efficiency. Now, this change could have been made to elevate Charlotte, to sharpen her role, to give her a stronger emotional and thematic presence. But instead, it appears to have been executed through the lens of her earliest incarnation, not her fully realized one. And this brings us to Scott Cawthon himself, who, this time around, served as the sole writer of the film's script. And I don't think it's controversial anymore to say that this was a questionable decision. Scott did not write the original film script. One of the scripts he even rejected was a script co-written by Scott himself and Keira Breed Risley, author of the Silver Eyes trilogy, and even he deemed that unfit for adaptation. So him taking on the job alone should raise an eyebrow. But the deeper issue, one that has become increasingly apparent as Scott continues to juggle multiple parallel timelines, the games, the Silver Eye novels, the books, and now the films, is that details bleed, conflict, or are occasionally forgotten altogether through which continuity he's working in. Information that is crucial in one continuity becomes inconsequential in another, or worse, gets mixed up in everything. And when you start borrowing characters and themes from later, more developed lore while anchoring them to earlier, less nuanced frameworks, the result is going to be dilution. The Secret of the Mimic offers a recent, very clear example of this problem. Anyone who has both read the story and played the game can see that SOTM represents a deliberate retcon of events that were once crucial to understanding Five Nights at Freddy's as it existed at the time. You can argue all you want that it was not a retcon, it was. But you cannot argue without directly lying to yourself, and knowing you're lying to yourself, that the Tales from the Pizzaplex series was pretty much paramount to understanding what was happening in the games at all. And to be fair, even I can admit that this isn't inherently a bad thing to have the game retcon the story of the books. Change was likely necessary, especially in the wake of security breaches, triple development, and Scott's evolving communication pipeline with his new creative appendage at Steel Wool Studios. So I could understand the desire to take what existed in the books, change them to not only fit a game framework, but also improve and elevate on what was already there, while at the same time trying to have your cake and eat it too, in fixing the problems in an earlier chapter that was a byproduct of flawed communication. And yet, in the story's final sequence between Edwin and the Mimic offhandedly refers to his new legs.
You know, speaking of legs, what do you think? I just finished mine.
You could argue that this line is meant to imply that in Edwin's fury, he damaged the Mimic so severely that it required repairs to the point of getting new legs. But that argument falls apart almost immediately because Edwin didn't just break the Mimic's legs, he destroyed everything about it. The call-out only makes sense if you're operating under the Mimic's original portrayal from the novellas, where he did not have legs.
We're going to go ahead and fix up one cool-looking endoskeleton. The thing looks homemade. The Murray guy who owned the building probably built it from bits and parts he picked up from all the machinery left here. I don't have my hopes too high on being able to salvage it. It looks pretty busted up. In fact, it's completely missing any legs.
meaning this line exists as a vestigial remnant of a version of the story that does not exist in the video game medium. A detail likely forgotten that wasn't included as development in the storyline progressed. And this exact problem reappears in the FNAF film, specifically with Charlotte Emily. In the games, Charlotte is depicted as a fundamentally protective figure, a caretaker. The original lore even establishes the missing children incident victims, minus Golden Freddy, require the puppet's intervention to properly possess the animatronics. Give gifts, give life. That is Charlotte's narrative function. That is her identity. The film gestures toward this characterization in the opening sequence where Charlotte attempts to protect and rescue a child William has abducted. But that thread is never followed. It never informs her behavior again. In fact, the plot of the film directly contradicts it. Charlotte uses Abby as a bargaining chip against Vanessa, threatening to have Twitchika kill her unless the perimeter lock is released. Later still, the puppet actively uses Abby as a vessel for possession in order to inflict further harm. Protecting children is not a defining trait of Charlotte in this continuity. If anything, she's portrayed as a volatile, indiscriminate spirit, lashing out with little regard for consequence or innocence. So why include that part of the opening scene at all? Why establish a moral framework that is immediately abandoned by the character the next time we see her? Because that is who Charlotte is in the games. And this problem only goes further when you start looking at character motivations and dialogue that feels stiff or unnatural. Not because the actors failed, but because the script is operating on the assumption that we already know information that was never actually established in this continuity. Yes, I know that the puppet was created by Charlotte's father, Henry, but I have no idea whether that remains true here. And honestly, there's a non-zero chance that this detail has already been quietly retconned somewhere in The Secret of the Mimic already. So Charlotte's early line in the film about the puppet being something that understands her, how Vanessa calls it her spirit guardian, feels so hollow and unfulfilled. The movie never elaborates on it, not once. Even in the single scene Mike shares with Henry, there is no discussion of why Charlotte might have a special connection to the puppet, or why that machine, of all things, matters to her the most. And again, the reason for this omission is painfully obvious once you think about it. Scott wrote the film as if this is a detail that is already well known, but forgetting that this is a new continuity, and I and you and everyone else who watches it, especially those who are newcomers, will not know if this information is true or not even have a clue that this information is even part of the storyline. It reminds me of a similar shortcut Marvel took with Spider-Man in Captain America Civil War, the MCU version, where Peter Parker's backstory is abrupt and vague, with the spider biting him, giving him superpowers, and Uncle Ben's death is barely referenced. But that works because Spider-Man is iconic. The story of Spider-Man is like the story of Batman and his origin story. So well known that as a side character in another person's story, yeah, we don't need further explanation beyond a little context. Here, though, in FNAF 2, with Charlotte and the puppet, there isn't even a hint. The context is simply dropped, and the film proceeds as if it has fully justified itself in its dialogue. But it absolutely has not. And if you don't believe me, remember that Henry's name was cut from the final version of this film, yet Mike still drops his name once in the pizzeria. That is just pure sloppiness. That's what happens when you're unsure which threads from which alternate timelines you've pulled from, which ones you've already established, and which ones you no longer need to explain. And the frustrating part is that none of these problems needed to exist. In fact, this entire sequence could have been strengthened dramatically and informatively if Scott has simply adhered more closely to the game's depiction of events. Take Charlotte's death as portrayed in Security Puppet and apply that to the movie's storyline. Children bullying harasser, blocking the puppet, a monitoring machine explicitly designed to observe and protect the children. You can even expand on this for the film continuity. Establish that the puppet can communicate directly with the toy animatronics, issuing commands if a child leaves the premises without an adult. Charlotte cries out, but parents are distracted, children are indifferent, and no one intervenes. Then William arrives, warm, kind, reassuring, and familiar. And once she's out of sight, he coldly stabs her in the back. You can still portray the puppet as a pure antagonist, one that seeks the destruction of adults. But now you've layered in something far more disturbing. Children are not spared her wrath either. After all, she doesn't in the film, so I don't know why that plot is brought up. Perhaps she does not blame William because he is merely one beast amongst many in a world she has judged unworthy of mercy. And again, apply more to the movie's continuity to this scene. Maybe Vanessa is part of the group bullying Charlotte. Or perhaps she was with her at the beginning of the film. Hell, throw in a brief Michael Afton cameo, let him be part of the crowd or the bullies, establish him more early on. You know, do something with him. With even modest adjustments, you could communicate vastly more information to both the newcomers and longtime fans, without relying on half-remembered lore or risking contradiction. The games would serve as an actual structural framework, not just a loose source of inspiration to be referenced and discarded when inconvenient. But no, instead we got this. Into the Night will be right back after these messages. Speaking of disappointments, Jesus Christ, was Fast Fest ever a complete waste of time? I genuinely do not understand the point of Fast Fest at all. Michael Afton's grand plan revealed in what is easily one of the most aggressively unpleasant scenes my retinas have ever been forced to process is to use the toy animatronics as instruments of mass murder, with the Fast Fest. Serving as the perfect cover. Okay, fine, sure. Except Toy Freddy is there, and he doesn't kill anyone in the film. In fact, Freddy and Bonnie are just sort of wandering around, casually, like they're looking for easy targets instead of executing some coordinated plan. Why? If there is a plan, why aren't they acting on it? Why are they meandering like an elderly person with dementia?
He's 29 years old with dementia! I forgot entirely what the fuck I was gonna say!
Oh, right. It's almost like the Michael Afton cameo didn't make any sense. Okay, no, we're skipping ahead here. I know we're at like the mid part / beginning. We just did the beginning and we're at the mid part, but we're skipping ahead. We can't do this. I can't do this. I need to talk about the characterization of Michael Afton first because wow, this was so ignoramus. I have no idea. I struggle to find words for this portrayal that don't feel inadequate. Every single decision made regarding this character feels like the exact opposite of what should have been done. Right down to the fundamental question of whether he needed to be in the film at all. And frankly, he didn't. You could remove Michael Afton entirely and lose nothing in this film. You could have the early 2000s YouTubers as a small documentary film crew. 3 people, no wider production team. Scott. And have them stumble upon Freddy's organically. Have the Fazfest encourage them to get in on the local Fazbear frenzy. Make the restaurant more isolated, outside of town, not within biking distance of the Schmidt household like it's a rundown Starbucks. But no, instead we got that ending. Oh god, that ending. That revealed that this was all Michael Afton's master plan to continue his father's legacy
you know, the legacy of sex people dead. That is baffling on so many multiple levels. First of all, Scott, you are not operating in-game canon here. In the film continuity, William Afton hasn't exactly built up some sprawling legacy of mass murder quite yet. He's killed 7 children at most, one of whom he kidnaps randomly in the woods with absolutely no explanation. If anything, it would have made infinitely more sense to make Mike Schmidt William's son, rather than introducing another Michael entirely, but whatever, we're nonsense land now. Anything goes. Like Michael strolling into the final scene of the film and monologuing about his grand design without being immediately attacked by the toy robots who were controlled by the puppet who previously attacked Michael Afton and were not shown to be working together. Which, you know, by the way, that would have been an actually interesting twist on the film. Puppet and Michael Afton working together for, you know, mass slaughter. But no, none of that. None of it addressed. It just occurs like an angel's kiss. But don't worry, other Mike and his family. The original animatronics show up too, despite the fact they have no idea where anything is happening. They all conveniently arrive to save the day, dismantling the toy robots with the ease of a child pulling off the torso of a Lego minifigure. You know, those same toy robots that shouldn't even be active because Schmidt Mike shut down the signal controlling them. An entire rule the film spends a significant chunk of its runtime establishing, only to completely forget it exists the moment it becomes inconvenient. You know, at this point, I'm not even mad. I'm just tired. Yeah. Okay, great now. Words cannot adequately describe how catastrophically disappointed I am with the FNAF 2 office section. Once again, the film is operating on rules that it never bothers to establish. The toy mask suddenly works on the M-Trunks. Why? How? Why does it not work on Foxy? Who knows? The movie certainly doesn't know. It just assumes we already understand this mechanic because we played the games. Which is not how films are supposed to function. You know, not that we're supposed to be constantly spoon-fed information, but, you know, nice to have some context of what's happening. And then there's Balloon Boy. Yeah, Mike snapping Balloon Boy's neck. That was funny. I laughed. We all laughed. But let's be serious for a half second. Balloon Boy is a machine made of metal, servos, and bolts, not a Halloween decoration held together with toothpicks. Even the fan service in the film is mishandled too, by the way. The withered animatronics are inexplicably retconned into being prototypes. What? You chose to include them, and this is what you do? And why is withered Bonnie the one stuck in the vent for most of the film? Withered Bonnie, the face of FNAF 2 iconography, arguably one of the most iconic animatronics by a mile. Meanwhile, Wither Chica, who has an entire gameplay mechanic in Yuxian revolving around her being too fat to properly maneuver vents, is right there, and you just don't use her that way. Why is everything wrong? Why is Michael moving at the speed of molasses on the computers? Deactivating systems that should take seconds somehow stretches into eternity. Not because it's difficult, but because the script demands he be slow. Tension through inefficiency is not intention, it's comical. And worse, in this case, it's padding. Now, to be clear, I don't hate the idea of the office section. Turning it into a guy in the chair setup actually makes sense. Mike has experience dealing with the animatronics in this system and this environment. Vanessa is an officer with field experience. They should be complementing each other's strengths, working together to stop Charlotte. That is a solid concept. But Mike isn't actually doing anything. He's not hacking, he's not improvising, he's not problem solving. And that's especially frustrating because the film could have easily justified it. Have Mike learn basic coding in between now and the first film. Make that the reason he can afford the new house at the beginning of the film. Then let those skills actually matter here.
But no, because apparently no one named Michael is allowed to be competent or have an arc in this movie. That's right, I said it. Michael Schmidt has no character arc, none. Josh Hutcherson is completely wasted, which is both impressive and tragic. Mike exists solely to react to Abby making catastrophic decisions every 5 minutes and to oscillate between being weirdly perceptive and emotionally inert, depending on what the scene needs from Abby. Vanessa is the actual protagonist, and I don't even mind that. She's more interesting. She's the child of an Afton. That's compelling. That's why Michael Afton worked in the game, Scott. But here, Mike Schmidt is just present, a passenger in this story. Abby, who in the first film can somehow sense spirits, can feel their presence somehow. But in this movie, apparently cannot tell the difference between the toy robots and the originals. Which brings me to another baffling question. Why in God's name does Abby care so much about Chica? Wouldn't that be the robot she had the most trauma associated with in the first film's events? Or am I misremembering the part where Chica walked her down a hallway and tried to shove her into a spring lock suit? I can forgive a child for being manipulated or confused, but the film treats Abby like she has a special, almost affectionate personal relationship with Chica in particular. And that makes absolutely no sense. It gets worse. Abby knows there are spirits of murdered children in those robots, yet she never once learned their actual names. She just keeps calling them by their robot mascot names. You're friends with Vanessa, Abby. You have access to the internet. You could ask, you could look it up, you could do anything to show basic respect for your so-called friends. Especially since FazFest is happening at all. How could Abby not have heard their names circulating? The entire event is rooted in the town's nostalgia for Freddy's, which would absolutely include the horror stories tied to it. The Silver Eyes literally open with a depiction of a memorial held on the 10-year anniversary of the MCI. So why does no one in this town find it remotely disturbing to dress up and party at the exact location where children were murdered? Why is Henry the only one who seems to care? Where are the parents of the MCI victims? Do they just not exist? Evaporated like dust, like a Thanos snap. Because the film treats the tragedy like a background lore instead of a wound that should still be festering in the community. And then there's Vanessa. Vanessa is broken. I'm sorry, she just is. Mike shouldn't have spoken out the way he did to her, you know, because the script required conflict. But Vanessa's behavior afterwards makes no sense. Mike disrespects you once, and instead of explaining that his sister has discovered a second restaurant, one you know is haunted by the girl Charlotte who Mike just discovered, who must be active given that the toys spoke to Abby, she says nothing. You withhold crucial information for no other reason than the script needing tension. And speaking of wasted setup, why the movie's marketing even hype up the toy animatronics talking? We get Kellan Goff playing Glam Rock Freddy, playing Toy Freddy. For what, like 4 lines of dialogue? And no disrespect to Kellan at all, he's great. He even said he wanted to portray Toy Freddy closer to the official voice, which begs the question, why not just hire the original voice actor for Toy Freddy? Toy Freddy and Toy Chica already have a defined voice in the games. Darren Roebuck and Amber Lee Connors do far better than Kellan's weird mixed portrayal of two characters he's playing and Megan Fox's portrayal. The originals strike a far better balance between kid-friendly mascot and a preternaturally disturbed machine.
You aren't as good at hiding as you think you are, you know.
Beyond MatPat making Toy Bonnie sound marginally better than his AR version, the toys in this film feel underutilized and just terribly characterized. And don't forget, Mangle was apparently kind enough to give Vanessa time. Time for Mike to find Toy Freddy and give his location to Vanessa. Time to get a head start on the open road before it attacked her on top of the van she was driving. How did you not see it, Vanessa? This is a broken machine that is a Frankenstein's monster. How do you not even hear it? And then again, this movie just can't decide how sound works with the robots. The toys are apparently loud enough to make rooms shake with thunderous footsteps, but also capable of silently teleporting like Michael Myers. Hell, by the end of the film, Michael Afton can teleport too. Jeremiah punches Michael Afton. Finally, you think justice be served. But wait, he is not just reacting to one group of Freddy robots. No, Jeremiah, waiting outside, has seen two separate groups of animatronics enter his house. And then when he watches this guy casually stroll in, what does Jeremiah do? Nothing. But when Mike runs out disturbed and panicked, then and only then, Jeremiah decides to confront Michael and just clotheslines him. And does he restrain him afterwards? No, he lets him get away. Brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. This is it's made for the fans, guys. And you know what? It's not even the dumbest choice in the film. Though, no, that award goes to Mike Schmidt, who somehow uses the music box to free his sister from the puppet's control, only to immediately close the infinite shield glitch. Like, that is a bro, this glue smells frickin' amazing level of thought process right there. And don't get me started on the scene that followed. I wanted to choke on razor blades just watching it. But hey, look on the bright side. Vanessa gets possessed by the puppet for reasons at the end. And apparently we're getting Springtrap in the next film. It's gonna be great, wonderful, absolutely delightful. That's what the Irish cream in my hand is telling me anyway. It's Irish cookies and cream. It's honestly, that's the point. I'm inclined to believe it.
The next day.
Okay. Now that I've had some coffee and a moment to breathe after all that, I want to make one thing clear. There are no people out there who genuinely love this film unconditionally. Clearly, I am not one of them. That said, I don't hate it. I recognize that it has merits. The costume design is impressive, the actors give it their all, and the film does include references that is for the fans that fans will appreciate. The kind of deep cuts that make you smile for all the time you've invested in the series. Pop Goes and the Candy arcade games, the Shadow Bonnie in the office, Circus Baby in the dream sequence. Those moments are genuinely fun. And that's one thing I will give this film. It's fun. If, asterisk, you don't take it seriously. But I want to take it seriously. Not as a grim, ultra-serious horror film. Fred has always thrived on dark humor and a tongue-in-cheek tone. But as a world and as characters that matter. For me personally, unlike the first film where I could rewatch and appreciate the things it got right, this second installment left me increasingly aware of what it got wrong. On my third rewatch of the film for the sake of this review, I found myself fixated more on decisions that were self-inflicted, not leveraging the main canon as a foundation of the story. Instead, writing yet another alternate universe, resorting to fan service to limp a plot to its conclusion, much like the Fourth Closet, and making narrative choices designed to justify a story written by someone who wasn't involved in the original film's script beyond quality control. Don't get me wrong, quality control is important, but it is not a substitute for thoughtful storytelling, which would likely be hindered on a continuation without someone with direct hands in the original narrative production. I say this honestly. I am glad FNAF has reached the point of having a film trilogy. But I hope Hollywood has had its turn and that we see no more after the third film. Films like these are useful as introductions to horror and as a nostalgia trip for longtime fans. But remembering the good old days of FNAF, I would rather want to appreciate art for its own sake, beyond the jangling of familiar keys and familiar faces. As I said in my review, I am an adult. FNAF is part of me, but it's not all of me. I play other games, I read other franchises, I engage with art that is self-contained, stories without extended universes, yet realized fully and profoundly told. And that is all any of us should ask from a narrative. Entertainment that can help us forget our lives for a moment, and then return to the world slightly inspired, energized, or wiser for it. Art should change us. It should leave us different than we were when it found us. If it leaves you feeling empty or lethargic or disappointed, and the work was genuinely intended as art rather than propaganda, then I'm sorry. It is simply bad art. And with that, I think we'll be concluding tonight's episode. I hope you've all enjoyed. And if you'd like to hear more, be sure to subscribe, follow, and share this podcast wherever you can. You can also check us out on YouTube, follow us on Twitter, and subscribe to our Patreon for early access to episodes and exclusive behind-the-scenes content. I have been your host, Nick Black, and I want to thank you all once again for listening. Have a good night, and drive home safe.